This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how was your birthday yesterday?
Oh.
Happy birthday.
It was just fine. Just like any other day.
I know. Good. Leave it to the introvert to now everybody. Chef AJ celebrated your birthday. Now we're going
right.
to say a little happy birthday for you.
Yeah. We'll skip it.
No crazy parties?
No,
okay,
nothing crazy at all. All right.
All right, we'll move along. We can tell you're pretty excited about it.
Yeah.
All right, so this just in the news, earlier this month, there was a group of psychologists from
mm-hmm.
King's College London and the University of Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
They were examining whether bad weather can trigger mm-hmm. feelings of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And through a series of, I think it was four experiments, they found that it actually does, that hearing wind, thunder, and to some extent rain, all led to subjects feeling increased nostalgia. And in addition to this, the weather-induced nostalgia was also linked with increased feelings of self-esteem, positive affect, social connectedness, and optimism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like reading these articles because right away I'll send them to you just because I want to hear your take on it because it's
right.
you give a much more complete answer. And so anytime I see things increasing self-esteem without actual hard work behind it, I always
right.
my little red flag antennas go off. So it seemed that most of the studies seemed to make sense, but I wanted to hear what your take on this was.
Yeah, first of all, when they a lot of the things that they measure in psychology, they're just they don't know what the hell they're measuring. So they'll put something on there like, well, I feel good about myself. And that's they're going to use that as an index of self-esteem. Or I feel more confident, or I feel like I could do things, better than other people. Who knows how they do it? In other words, we have to look at whatever they think they're measuring. It was a very sloppy conceptually. So I'm never, anybody thinks that they're measuring self-esteem, they're usually measuring confidence is what they're measuring. So, I think that other people would like me. That's not self-esteem. That's measuring confidence, but that's what they think they're measuring. And it turns out that self-esteem scales and depression scales correlate beautifully. So essentially what they measure as self-esteem is essentially the antithesis of depression. So that's how it comes across. So the way I think about self-esteem is more precise, and it ferrets out, it gets us away from self-confidence, which I can understand why Bandura jumped up and down and tried to explain to everybody that perceived self-efficacy was not the same thing as self-confidence. It isn't. They're very, very similar. And in fact, perceived self-efficacy causes self-confidence. Self-confidence is a feeling that is based upon a person's perception of efficacy. The self-esteem is something very different. The work that is required to work at something to do well that will cause the self-esteem mechanism to be enhanced. In other words, your internal audience will watch you and give you positive feedback. the work that you do will then increase your self-confidence because you will improve. And so the or as Bandura would argue, it will increase your self-efficacy, which will increase your self-confidence. So they're interrelated phenomena, but they're not the same thing. So anyway, okay, that's a bit of a sideways discussion. So now we're going to look at what's curious about this. You told me about this last week, and I found this very interesting. And I actually read somewhere, and I believe it, I could never put my finger on the sentence where I read this, but it seems to me that it was in Tubian Cosmides, or it may have been in Steven Pinker's somewhere buried, or somebody else, that there's a feeling for humans when they are indoors and protected and the weather is bad, that is a good feeling. And that's a very interesting feeling. It's probably, I'm trying to think about why that is. I haven't thought it all through yet. I think it's because your imagination can imagine what it would be like to be out in the bad weather, and the fact that you are out of the bad weather, you know, is creating a delta between where you are and where you could be. And it's similar to thinking that, oh boy, the good feeling that you might have after just missing somebody in a potential auto accident. It's like, whoa, that was close. Okay, oh, that feels a relief. Okay, so you can imagine that staring at lightning and thunder and seeing a landscape get drenched and it's dark and foreboding. All of that, when you are huddled in and warm and safe, creates a difference, which could generate good feelings in the organism. Now, the fact that good feelings like that could generate nostalgia is curious. I have no idea why they were thinking that it would do such a thing. I have no idea why. And do they come up with any? Do they suggest any theory as to why that would be?
Not really. They did four different studies that kind of mm-hmm. pieced this together, and they were just mm-hmm. they were surveys, and mm-hmm. they were
right.
done with so they didn't really figure out why this would was happening.
Right. It's interesting. So strangely enough, this is an example of a psychologist, some one of those people that was involved in this got it in their noggin because they noticed it in themselves. And I can almost agree with them. In other words, I kind of get the feeling that they're right about this, and I'm not sure why this would be. But it, like I said, it escapes me why this would be true, but it doesn't surprise me that they have found this. There's a feeling of this feeling of being safe and then potentially being huddled in with other people, and that we're all in a little coalition and we're safe and warm and protected, et cetera. So this could be also harken back to other such times when we were in the same situation. So that's a real stretch, and I have no idea why that they would find this particular effect exactly. It doesn't fit into any frame that I have. I do, however, remember reading this notion of that by an evolutionary psychologist somewhere, that this was that us being safe and warm and protected when the weather's bad is something that generates positive feelings for people. I guess it makes some basic sense that would be true. But that's all I know about that, and I don't know any more about it.
Yeah, what was curious is they were saying that nostalgia is a way that we cope with bad mm-hmm. weather. And one of their experiments, they actually prevented participants from becoming nostalgic by cognitive mm-hmm. overload.
Yeah.
And the bad weather actually made them more distressed. And so their postulation is that nostalgia counteracts distress made by bad weather.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, it's
and
really
now we're getting we're getting a Mickey Mouse theory. The and so this is where we get Mickey Mouse theorizing that isn't attached to anything that makes sense. There isn't a reason. This is a psychodynamic. The system is not designed by nature to cause itself to feel good. Whether or not they've identified a thread of truth in here is irrelevant. The reasoning that they're postulating, if you're reporting this accurately, which wouldn't surprise me if you are, because I've seen psychologists talk like this for 35 years. And it wasn't until I discovered evolutionary psychology after 10 years of it, after 10 years of formal education, that finally the bullshit, you know, finally the heavens opened and I saw the light. Okay. So the notion in Freudian psychology is that the system wants to feel good, therefore the ego or the id or the superego or does this or does that, and it's all being pushed around so that the organism can feel good. That is not the purpose of the psychology of the organism. It's not designed to feel good. It's designed to have the organism suffer, be in misery, be panting, be wanting, be frustrated, be traumatized, or be whatever the hell else it needs to do in order to be effective. The only purpose of feelings is to increase the statistical likelihood of survival and reproductive success. It's not to feel better. So the notion that the system would somehow generate nostalgia because the outside weather is making the system feel bad and we want to feel good, so we want to feel nostalgic, and that's going to cast a positive frame over our otherwise frightening experience, is just ludicrous. Okay, so the fact that there may be some grains of causality in there where they could be accurately identifying a pattern is fine, but that reasoning is nuts. It's what I call lost in non-Darwinian space. You know, if you're the Will Robinson, you know, danger Will Robinson. If you don't understand how the system is put together and why it was put together, then you're not going to understand why it works the way it works. So, that's my rant for the night about non-Darwinian theorizing and psychology. That's why psychodynamic views don't wash, and they fundamentally cannot and will not hold together. Pieces of the patterns that people identify, you know, can hold together. In other words, they don't hold together in a coherent way, but they are legitimate observations. The notion that human beings looking at bad weather or being inside in bad weather may have their mind drift towards nostalgic thinking is a fascinating concept, just as an observation, and I don't know why. Don't know how true it is, and I don't know why it would be true, but I know for sure why it isn't true. In other words, I know one thing that isn't the case about it, and it's not the case so that a stressed organism looking at a dangerous environment will, quote, feel better. That I know is wrong. And so anyway.
That's fantastic. Okay, that answers the questions. Yeah.
You poked the bear and it bit. Okay, very good.
Love it.
All right, what else we got?
Well, my theory, I mean, my, you know, layman's theory was that increases feelings of nostalgia in bad weather is when the village comes together when there's bad weather and everyone's trying to be social. They're all sharing their stories together so they can all get a little bit of status and everyone can kind of...
You know what? That's a hell of a lot better than the idea they had. Okay. So I'll give you a pass on that. That's good. That's actually good thinking, and that could be true. If you think about a bunch of Stone Age villagers, or half-assed confederation of people that aren't even a defined village. So we'll go back 800,000 years, perhaps before there was well-defined villages, then yes, you could see how the getting closer together in bad weather might be a useful thing, and the notion of coming together and then telling stories or communicate, et cetera. It, you know what? I like it. I like it a hell of a lot better than anything I've thought of so far. Good job. All right.
Cool. Got a little circuit flood here. I like that. All right.
Yeah. All right. Where
All
are we
right.
going now?
Oh, yeah. So I also wanted to bring up the reason I started thinking about this article was because a couple of days ago, a little injury that I've had once in a while when I was playing hockey, it flared up. And after I got over, you know, every once in a while it flares up here and there. So I'm sitting in the chair, you know, working on some stuff. And I found that if I just moved just right, it would hurt just enough to like trigger some tears. And I thought that's really interesting. And I would like move a different way and it wouldn't hurt. Then it would hurt so much that it would trigger little tears. And I thought, I wonder if that's also an emotion, you know, similar to this nostalgia that triggers, you know, signaling to other people that you need help.
You are absolutely getting it. Now you're understanding what it's like to walk around the world with what I call the Chucky Darwin glasses on. Once you put the Chucky Darwin glasses on, you just can't see life the same way anymore. That is fascinating, Nathan, and that's a really, really good observation. That's good thinking. Yeah. So you get pain at a certain level, activates the tear mechanism because it's probably associated with significant enough potential dysfunction or increasing damage that you need to elicit help from other people. And that is fascinating, and you're right. They could be what you're referring to here. This could be an absolutely parallel phenomenon. Very good. Good thinking.
Wow. Yeah,
all
which
right.
is strange because usually I only cry during like really emotional commercials and, you know, when the lights come off and like I'm scared of the dark. But
right.
Yeah.
Right. I got it. No, that's good. Very good.
All right. All right. So our next question, this is from a student studying for the MCAT. Dr. Lyle, do you have any suggestions for how to start studying and actually study for the MCAT? I'm severely ego-trapped and have procrastinated about applying to medical school and writing the MCAT for many years. I have a severe fear of failure and have been crippled by expectations, my own, my family, etc. Please help.
Well, it's interesting. First of all, if you put it off for too many years, then your classes are no longer any good and you can't go to med school anyway. So you better check on that. Make sure that your anatomy and phys and chemistry and everything else will still fly. If you haven't checked on that, you could be under the gun, and this could be your last rodeo or close to it. So keep in mind that this whole thing may be on the clock, which is a potentially useful thing. The ego trap is a certainly nasty situation. So this person, obviously very bright, probably did well enough at school as a bio or similar major for others to believe that this person could get into medical school, which is no small feat to do it. So obviously there's legitimate questions as to how well the person will do and whether or not they will do enough to be able to get into medical school. So I would point out to the listener that if you're a genius, we already would have known it by now and you already would have gotten in. So let's keep in mind that what you are is a very bright human, and there's an awful lot of very bright humans, millions of them. And it's going to turn out that, unfortunately, if you're a very bright human, it's easy enough to get a familial situation or a social situation and be inherently sensitive enough to the ego trap that you can get yourself into a hell of a mess, because you can be the smartest kid in your little third grade class. But it just means that you're one of millions of people that has my dad used to have a phrase to describe this, very, very overly simplistic, okay, obviously. He used to say, you know what, you either have a functioning brain or you don't. And what he meant by that was you're either what you call smart or you're not. And if you're not smart, then you're not going to be doing anything big, fancy, or complicated. And if you are smart, you could, but you're going to have to get off your rear end and work for it, because there's an awful lot of other smart people in the world, and these are generally competitive processes. And so, you know, you're going to have to work. So the idea that you are very bright and you should be able to waltz through makes no sense at all. Keep in mind that if you're smart, you probably got 1,375 cc's of brains in your head, putting you at, you know, the 95th percentile or above. But other people that have 1,370, if they work a little harder than you, they're going to beat you. And if you work a little harder than the person with 1,380, you're going to beat them. And what's up here when it comes to medical school is one hell of a sword fight. And what it's going to take is not only a lot of hard work, but it's going to take hard work that's effective. So you're going to have to outsmart a bunch of your competitors. And outsmarting a bunch of your competitors is not going to be easy, because they're very smart people. This is no joke to get into medical school. So what I would tell you is that the solution to getting out of the ego trap is actually to begin the process of doing the fundamentals. So you want to have a method of you need to define the nature of the entire mess, all the little subtests of the MCAT. You need to get all the review materials, and then you need to begin a process where you're not wasting your time just by glossing your eyes over the pages, but you want to be doing a process that I would suggest, or something similar to it. If the people may have invented better processes than the ones that I have. But the process that I would suggest is that you essentially rewrite the notes in your own hand, either in your own handwriting or typing. And if you rewrite them, in other words, everything that you need to learn, you need to synthesize and get it into your own words. And then you need to set up quizzes that are a facsimile of your notes, except that they're cued recall, so a bunch of the information is missing. And then you need to, once you do a section, whatever that section is, probably 10 pages of text, then you need to have a quiz on that 10 pages. And then before you go on to the next 10 pages, you need to quiz that information into perfection. And so this, you know, you could cover several pages a day of material. So you could cover, you know, you could probably learn, you know, 10 pages a day of pretty serious material over 3 or 4 or 5 hours. And then you could do this 300 days a year, 250 days a year. You can cover a hell of a lot of ground. So you can cover a couple of thousand pages of material in a year. So a year from now, as you go through the process, this is very much like laying the bricks to build a home. It's brick by brick by brick by brick. And one of the advantages of having quizzes where you have written the material and you quiz yourself is you don't go back and reread any of the old materials that you already covered and synthesized for yourself. You just continue forward synthesizing more material and then going back very periodically and quizzing the existing material that you already learned back to perfection. So by a process of accretion over a period of months, you can keep, you can essentially integrate more and more and more and more information. There's for all intents and purposes, there's no limit to the information that you can maintain hot in memory if you're continuing to drill. You could certainly do more than any of your competitors are likely to do, so you can do well on the MCAT. Now, we have to understand that our goal here is slightly different than the goal that we may think that we're seeking. So we think we're seeking the esteem of getting into a good med school or getting into med school, and then having a stethoscope around our neck and having them say, Dr. Davidson, report to emergency. Dr. Davidson, to emergency. And you're like, that's me. Okay. We think that this is what we're up to, but the most important part of the journey is not that. The most important part of the journey is to actually be doing the fundamentals that are associated with the learning. And so the beautiful news to this is that the good feelings of self-esteem can come in a matter of 3 or 4 days. You can actually be out of the ego trap in 3 or 4 days. It's very dynamic, okay? If you set up a grand plan and you see the 2,000 pages that you're going to try to get synthesized, you're going to go as far as you can in a year between now and the time you take the MCAT. And then what you're going to do is you're going to set aside whatever hours are reasonable, and don't set it too high because you need time to sleep, exercise, work, whatever else it is that you do. So if you were to set aside, I don't know, 14 hours a week for the MCAT, you would, in those 2 hours, you wouldn't be studying straight for 2 hours. You'd study 10 or 15 minutes on, 5, 10 minutes off, 10, 15 minutes on, 5, 10 minutes off, go back and forth for 2 hours. So you might actually be even just sitting and writing for 60 or 75 minutes a day. Now, if you did that and you make these quizzes and you start to quiz the information, from the first time that you knock down the first 10 pages and you have a quiz and then you quiz it to perfection, your self-esteem, if you notice very quickly, will take a notch up. It can't help it. It doesn't really have any choice. It's a mechanical device that's watching whether or not you are putting out an excellent effort, and it will change its internal dialogue and internal assessment of what it is that you're doing. Right now, you're fiddling around, not doing anything, essentially avoiding this, terrorized by the ego trap. You're in a hell of a mess. So we're going to get out of that mess by actually spending, 10 hours of the kind of effort that I'm talking about, and we're going to see whether a 10-hour investment in this effort actually shifts your internal feelings. And my hypothesis and my extremely strong expectation is that it will. Now, the beauty of discovering this is to discover one of the most important discoveries that a human being can make about how they work, which is that when it comes to a great deal of your internal experience or your life experience, a great deal of it is driven by your self-esteem mechanism, not driven by the esteem mechanism. The esteem mechanisms are very loud. They make a lot of noise. There's nothing like getting esteem from other people that you want. There's nothing like it. But there's also nothing like the more quiet internal process of self-esteem. And there's only one way to do it, and that's through grit. And it's going to turn out that in the process of you beginning the process of studying and putting out the 10 hours of grit, because if you've been doing as much suffering as you've been doing for as long as you've been doing it, the least we can do is put out 10 hours of grit to find out whether or not that we can cut our way through this emotional, nightmare, like we're cutting our way through a spider web. It's really not that hard. It only seems like it's hard. Now, so this is what we're up to. And I want this person and anybody else that is being stopped by something similar to look at this as a fascinating adventure. And not only a fascinating adventure, one of unbelievable importance for your self-discovery, to find out that you can turn your life around in a matter of hours, and yet you could have been suffering for years. This is a core insight that I'm writing about in the book that I'm writing now called Esteem Dynamics. The notion that our self-esteem or that our esteem are very intractable, and that they're very fixed, and that essentially that they're not subject easily to movement because it's dependent upon traumatic things that happened to us 30 years ago or how we were raised or anything else under the sun. They're not, okay? Esteem processes are inherently dynamic, just like the hunger drive, just like thirst, just like temperature regulation and everything else under the sun. Things are dynamic, and it's going to turn out that the dynamic you need to know to get out of this mess is that self-esteem responds to grit. Something else happens when you sit down and actually put out the elbow grease and do the best you can, whether you're trying to write a poem or whether you're trying to memorize anatomy and phys, or whether or not you're trying to get through chemistry, or whether or not you're trying to, I don't know, anything else, get your restaurant working more effectively. Anything that you do where you work diligently at the process, what will happen is if you've been intimidated that the process was overwhelming, what will happen is that you will soon not be intimidated. What will happen is that in this case, the person is intimidated by the fear that they are not going to be as good as they think their PR is, you know, and as good as their internal PR is. So the expectations are high, and that's a hell of a trap. So the internal audience can actually have overly high expectations for your productivity when it comes to studying. However, when you start to study and it turns out that you're not as smart as your internal audience thought you were, but you continue to work diligently, then what will happen is the internal audience will recalibrate. So at first it will experience a bit of surprise and disappointment in your relative lack of abilities, but pretty soon as you continue to grind and continue to make forward progress, it will then get a sense of how easily you make forward progress, and it will calibrate you appropriately. And then you will be out of the ego trap and we'll be done with it. So that's how this is done. And if you, it is not a tragedy, folks, to do the grind and then find out we're not as brilliant as we thought we were. There is some disappointment and there is some embarrassment associated with such things, but it is no tragedy. This is something that one of my favorite examples is that I believe 85% of 8th grade boys believe they're going to be professional athletes. This is not a tragedy. So maybe to some parent watching their would-be star to find out that they can't make the sophomore team at their high school, you know, in the 10th grade, it's like, oh, no, well, that's terrible because he was on the 8th grade team and then he didn't make the 9th grade team, but that's because the coach was a jerk because he really would have been a star on the 9th grade team at the junior high school. So we really expected him to shine, and so did he, because after all, he was headed for the Lakers. But in fact, it looks like he's headed to, maybe if he's got a brain, he's headed to Caltech, and it's time to put away that dream. And this is no tragedy. So the recalibration of personal expectations is no tragedy. The nature of the human experience is going to be that disappointments are inevitable, and they are in no way tragic. And we have a bizarre meta theory that enshrouds modern pop psychology, which is the notion that disappointments may hurt, quote, the person's self-esteem, which then, quote, hurts their, you know, damages their little internal self, and therefore, reduces the upward mobility of their life experience. Not true. Okay, disappointment does nothing of the kind. Disappointment is just a part of a recalibration process that puts us in a position to more accurately analyze the cost-benefit analysis of efforts in a given domain. It's no problem at all, okay? So what this person should do, if they have a dream that they are pursuing and they want to do this, get out the books, define the scope of what it is that we're trying to accomplish, and let's work at the first 1% of this process and get moving. And what I will suggest to you is that within 10 hours of effort dedicated at this, the ego trap will be shattered and we will be moving forward. All right.
Absolutely fantastic, Dr. Lau. We're going to take a quick question and then we're going to get to our caller who's been on hold.
Okay. Very
caller
good.
We didn't get to last week.
All
Dr. Lyle, this is a question that as soon as I read it, I was like, I really want you to answer this. So, Dr. Lyle, if someone asks me where I get my protein from and there are potential mating partners listening in, should I just go ahead and grandstand to score some points, or can it also pay to appear more laid back and not concerned about my status? It's a great question by a listener.
That's a beautiful question. And it's got to be a male asking this. So it's a female would never need to grandstand. So at least I hope that the women understand this. So hopefully this is a guy, and the guy is thinking that this is an opportunity to beat everybody over the head with the information that they haven't heard before. No, this is not the time to do this. Do the second version, which is to just be cool, make no big deal about it, and forget it. The pleasure trap is the notion about food and health. These are such touchy little subjects, and people have beliefs that they know, or they believe that you don't know. And this is no place to be scoring points. Score points somewhere else. This belongs in the politics, religion, and protein. That's what that is. Yeah, forget it. Great question, though. It's a question of beauty. All right.
Okay, so we have Anonymous calling to the show. How you doing, Anonymous?
Hey, how's it going? That's a great name for me.
Very good. What's your? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your name is Anonymous. Okay, I was going to just ask you your name, but now I got who it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Thanks for calling. Tell us the story. What's going on? What are we working on? What are we trying to get better?
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say this is the most fantastic and fascinating topic of podcasts out there. You guys deserve to have millions of listeners every week. There's nothing like it.
We're having fun. Thanks for saying that. All right.
So my wife and I are going to be having a kid soon, and mm-hmm. have to say we're really excited to basically have a pet with our DNA. That's a fantastic image to have.
Yeah.
As you've mentioned before. So my question is, we know that what kids are exposed to isn't going to shape their personality, but it sounds like at least for short-term behavior and the mimicking they experiment with, what they're exposed to does probably influence them quite a bit. But, you know, I see some kids of friends and family come home and they're repeating some of the most, to me, just some of the most obnoxious things that their friends are rubbing off on them, or stuff from dumb TV shows or movies. And this is from a very selfish perspective. Is there any point in trying to, try to filter what types of TV shows and other kids are exposed to for the sake of our own sanity and enjoyment of our pets as parents? I wouldn't want, as a kid, to hang out with most adults. You know, I'd want to go ask my friends to play. But, maybe if we as adults are fun-loving, we're easygoing, we relieve them of all the pressure that's typical, they would enjoy hanging out with us. My underlying question is there any harm in kids spending more time than typical with adults, or maybe older kids, or do they really do best when they can go wild just as much as possible with kids their age?
Bunch of interesting little questions you have there. We can just kind of have a discussion, but let me give you my take on what I believe to be true and what we're really after here is we're after everybody enjoying their process.
Yeah.
So we're not so worried about what they're turning into, because pretty much they're going to turn into what they're going to turn into. So, you know, you weren't going to take Charles Manson and turn him into Mother Teresa. Okay, this was not going to happen. So pretty much the evidence on the monozygotic twin studies tells the story that pretty much these personalities are the personalities. Now, one place where people get confused listening to me, or people like me that are knowledgeable in behavior genetics, is that there's a difference between saying that we don't influence a kid's personality versus saying we don't influence their life. You can influence a person's life dramatically and not have influenced their personality by 1%. So what we want to do, what do I mean by this? If you have a person that works, let's suppose they get their first job and they go and they work for a pizza place, and the boss is just an abusive bastard, okay? And the mom and dad are pleasant and remote, kind of remote to their kid, and they don't, you know, they're pleasant enough, and they kind of let the kids do what they want to do. And they have some very simple philosophies, and they don't have, you know, really good communication with the kids necessarily. They don't necessarily need to. And so their attitude is, oh yeah, well, when you have a job, sometimes there's some crap. You got to take the good with the bad. Yeah, that's what the paycheck's for. So this kid doesn't actually understand that this is, you know, the kid sort of just figures, well, this is what mom and dad say. You got to take the good with the bad, and you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. And it turns out they're really in a very unpleasant situation with a disagreeable SOB. And they work there for 2 or 3 years. Now, you might say, oh, well, that's, you know, maybe bad things or damage or anything else. There's no damage done by this. It's just 3 years of suffering every time they go to work. It's not damaging to them, but it's lousy. Okay? A lousy life experience. He could have worked at the other pizza place with a perfectly decent boss and have the you know, one of the times of his life. Way better situation. So as a parent, what you want to be is you want to be monitoring your kids, you know, the quality of their emotional life. You want to be trying to, as best you can, engineer moods of happiness inside the child. And so that's our job. And the kid is designed by nature to seek out things that cause the kid to have moods of happiness. So fortunately, they're an engine that is trying to figure this out on their own, and they're figuring it out about as fast as they can figure it out. But your job is to try to protect them in their environments so that they're not putting up with a bully. They don't have some horrendous, awful teacher that they cannot stand or doesn't like them or has some, you know, is just an unpleasant human being. We don't want them to have to spend a year with some nutcase that makes their life unpleasant. So we're looking out to try to maneuver our child not to the ultimate softest environment, but an environment that is appropriate, reasonable, fair, predictable, etc. In other words, a good situation. That's what we're trying to do. Now, when it comes to this, we're not necessarily indulging anybody when it costs us and makes our lives unpleasant. So remember, this is a group dynamic here. So parents will sometimes, you know, wonder, gee, should we take the computer away from the kid, and we're so frustrated, you know, he doesn't clean his room and it's upsetting. It's like, hell yes, take the computer away from the kid if he doesn't have his room clean and it disturbs you. Are you kidding me? In a nanosecond, okay? I take the cell phone away too in a nanosecond. And when it comes to exposed to other kids, if they come home and show any attitude, use language that I don't like or anything else, it's like, hey, we better not be seeing that around here. No go. It's not how we do things, okay? And if they can't seem to reel it in, then we start curbing who it is that they're going to be interacting with. So the notion here is that you are here to enjoy this process, and they are here to enjoy this process, and you want to use a reasonable view of how much control you are going to impose over their environment, not to, quote, influence their development, but rather to optimize their life experience. You're going to be over the top of this kid with an eagle eye for 20 years. And that's a lot. That's a huge percentage of their existence. And it won't determine what the next 60 years of their life will be after that, but it will be. It will determine the quality of that existence in those 20 years. So the job is, you know, enjoy the process. Attempt to engineer their happiness and your own alongside it. When there are conflicts, there's going to be conflicts, and those conflicts are inevitable. And, you know, take care that as a big person, you ultimately have more control than the little person. And just the fact of listening to who you are and how you think, I already know that you're not going to abuse that power 1%. If anything, you'll probably let the kid run over you. Fair enough, okay? The genes are going to beat you probably fairly often in the next 20 years. That's okay. But remember, don't fear the fact that when you need to step up to sort of push the balance between whose interest is being served in your own direction. You know, if my pets cause me too much trouble, then they have some things that don't go the way they like them. When the
time
cat
out.
Sometimes wakes me up early, sometimes she gets a little squirt bottle in the face. So anyway, all right. So does this all make some sense?
Yeah, that's fantastic. I really appreciate the perspective. You were more of we're a guardian. We're watching out for them, and we're in their corner. So
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. You got it. All right.
Very cool.
Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. Very good question.
Excellent. Thank you very much for the call. All right, Dr. Lyle, that about wraps it up. Thank you so much.
Yay.
Just love the feelings discussion and the ego trap. That's really fantastic.
Yeah, a lot of people face that in various guises across their lives. And so, yeah, once we learn to take a deep breath, jump in, suffer the quiet internal, you know, anxiety about this and slight embarrassment, but then we start to grit our teeth and put some grit to it, we will find that we can get out of this thing very quickly, and that's an important thing to know.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.